One of the most familiar axioms of Adventist experience, at least as heard at the level of the church foyer, the conversations in the parking lot, and the letters to the editor, is that Adventists shouldn't get involved in politics. That phrase has become so standard as to often be without question. And by that, many individuals mean, appropriately enough, that the church ought not to, and is in some cases legally prevented from, taking positions on partisan political topics. We do not and cannot make endorsements, and campaigning must stay outside the foyer of the church. But to say that Adventists shouldn't or haven't historically gotten involved in things political is not accurate as frequently as it is stated. The truth of the matter is that every faith planted on the earth at some point becomes political by very definition of its involvement with society, unless it is truly cultic and apocalyptic and waiting for its translation or removal from the earth. It engages in relationships in its society which means that it becomes willy-nilly political in some fashion. I discover this frequently in the responses that come to an editor's desk. Let a church leader recommend a sensible Christian concern for the environment, and someone will write, "Adventists shouldn't get involved in politics." Let the magazine do as it has historically done and encourage readers to support anti-tobacco legislation on Capitol Hill, and someone will write, "Adventists shouldn't get involved in politics." Let them have their cigarettes, we'll have our Sabbath, is the logic that is presented. Let a pastor pray for victims of war in Iraq or Afghanistan, and a chorus of voices will say, "Adventists shouldn't get involved in politics." And yet Adventists have, from their very inception, been engaged with selected social issues with a clarity, and I might add at times a vociferousness, which is indeed surprising. In fact, I find myself flinching at times as I read through the pages of the magazine I now have the privilege of editing to discover the language used there that I would not dare dream of using even in my most strongly worded editorials. It was routine at the birth of the Seventh-day Adventist movement in mid-19th century. The magazine and the movement were birthed at a time of a titanic struggle in American society about the issue of slavery. And the magazine took an unequivocal position, as did virtually every Adventist of that era, against the trafficking in human persons and in slavery. Their position, they believed, was a profoundly moral and biblical one, and you have probably never read in any journal today such denunciatory language about the national government as was routinely in the columns of the magazine I now edit. It helps a little bit to see a piece of social context. I have been challenging members of my staff in fun recently that I had a theory that Adventists must have been engaged in a fairly deep social conversation with others in the abolitionist movement, given that the Adventist Review was published in Rochester, New York, at exactly the time that Frederick Douglass was printing the North Star there. One of my staff members took me up on the challenge 2 weeks ago and discovered that the home of James and Ellen White was 500 feet from the home of Frederick Douglass, and next door to him was a prominent Millerite. They were all engaged in conversation. I came to this conclusion by reading Frederick Douglass's North Star and the Adventist Review and discovering that you could swap out their columns on abolition and not know which was which. That in fact there was a shared intellectual community that made Adventists political in their society. A sample of that writing will be perhaps enough. If you discover I am writing language like this, I suppose you will write your own letter to the editor. Uriah Smith, second editor. Says the Declaration of Independence, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." And yet, the same government that utters this sentiment, in the very face of this declaration, will hold in abject servitude over 3,200,000 of human beings, rob them of these rights of which they acknowledge that all men are endowed by their Creator, and write out a base denial of all their fair professions in characters of blood. In the institution of slavery is more especially manifested thus far the dragon spirit that dwells in the heart of this hypocritical nation. I have not yet been courageous to write words like that. But the criticism became in some cases more profoundly personal. 1856, the election of Mr. Buchanan, 15th President of the United States. The election of Mr. Buchanan was a great triumph of the worst of causes, of slavery and slaveholders over Christianity and Christian churches. Well, the position of the church on slavery has been recognized in its society and in subsequent decades as to be the morally high ground. And as Seventh-day Adventist, I am proud, extremely proud of the clear, unequivocal position this movement took for human dignity and for biblical understanding of human worth. But it didn't stop with that one issue. By the 1880s and 90s, as the reunion of North and South was happening at the expense of freed African Americans, a wave of lynching took over the American South. And you will discover in the pages of this same magazine 100 references to the indignities and the tragedies of lynching. It resulted in a series of editorial notes, as the magazine over a 10-year period took the opportunity to pointedly criticize the culture that would attempt to deprive people of their rights and their dignity. An illustration. Again, I might lack the courage to write words like this. After reporting a particularly dreadful incident of lynching in South Carolina, we are loath to credit these dreadful details, but if they be not denied, we shall have no alternative. If they are true, then we ask, where in China, Armenia, Africa, or any other place this side of the infernal regions, do we find anything more barbarous and devilish? If the whole civilized world is justified in disciplining the Turk for outrageous cruelty, then certainly our southern ports ought to bristle with foreign arms come to teach this country some lesson in the common principles of humanity. The last time an editor of this magazine asked for foreign intervention to help us get our politics and society straight was probably 1895. I point this out to illustrate there was a context of Adventists getting involved in selected social issues that they believed had moral impact. The great 40-year campaign of the Adventist Church, along with others in society, for alcoholic prohibition, personally and strongly endorsed on dozens of occasions by one of its co-founders, Ellen White. And all the pages of all the magazines published by this church, the Review and Herald, Liberty Magazine, which on the back page printed petitions to sign in favor of alcoholic prohibition, Liberty Magazine, in fact, which its tradition in recent decades might have suggested they not go that way. It was the consensus position of this church for 40 years to support alcoholic prohibition, both for its moral impact on society and, as argued very ably by many Adventists who were engaging with their society, because of the social and economic impact that alcohol was having on the nation. And in fact, as F.D. Nichol wrote in one book in the 1930s, as the campaign was failing and the amendment was being repealed, that while the argument at one point rested on tears and emotion, it now rests on cold, hard cash. That, in fact, economic interests was a way to appeal to their society about a matter that Adventists cared greatly about. A local illustration of that is that in 1915, here in Berrien County, dozens of students of Emmanuel Missionary College presented 21 anti-alcohol presentations throughout Berrien County urging the passing of a law, which was enacted, against alcoholic sales here in this county. That was celebrated. It was a routine part of Adventist experience. On the back pages of our magazines were maps showing which areas were wet and dry and which legislators ought to be encouraged to do the right thing. The issue didn't stop with alcoholic prohibition, however. By 1921, with a man in the White House in Warren G. Harding, who had very close Adventist relatives, a sister and a mother, among others, there was an open letter written to Warren Harding urging him to strongly back a convention on disarmament then occurring in Washington, D.C. signed by the President of the General Conference of the Secretary, it read, "As Seventh-day Adventists, in common with other religious bodies, we strongly favor a limitation of armaments, and if it were possible in the present state of society, we would favor the abolition of all war among the nations of men." A disarmament appeal on the front pages of the Church's leading journal. Again, selected issues the Church has found at various moments both the precedent and the courage to make a statement. My perspective to those who would argue that the Church ought not to involve itself in any of today's pressing social issues is to ask them, on what basis do you make that claim? The claim is usually an ahistorical one, meaning individuals not acquainted with the history of this people. To me, it seems imperative that as we move forward, we carefully consider that history, noting its cautions, noting that it was not reacting to all things that were coming down the social highway, that it saved its moral weight and freight for those issues it believed crucially involved its interests. My concern is not so much to advocate for any outcome in the present thing as to set the stage for the Church to, in fact, engage with its society if it chooses to. Its choices are yet in the future in terms of how it may relate to the issue under discussion here. That discussion, however, is a legitimate one. The history supports that the denomination, in fact, may and will address selected topics. It will, of course, also pay some price for its involvement in the public square. Its involvement in alcoholic prohibition still remains in the minds of some Adventist scholars and some laypersons a matter of controversy, even though it was the great majority position of the Church at that time. The Church has not always found its voice at other moments. We look to the decade of the 1960s and notice a conspicuous silence on issues of civil rights until, in some cases, too late to effectively help lead at a time when the nation, the society, and the Church needed leadership. Other moments in our history have also have been times when we have not always found our voice at the right moment. I point to the illustration of what happened to Adventists and other Japanese Americans in their incarceration at the beginning of World War II. And they plaintively pled with Church leadership to speak out for their civil liberties as American citizens. And a few things have saddened me more than to read the letter from a General Conference officer who said, "This is not a matter of our concern, it is a matter of politics." Well, if the incarceration of American citizens is not a matter of concern to the Church here on the basis of their civil liberties being denied, much of our discussion of religious liberty is mooted by that. Our discussions here today occur in a particular context. 160 years now, at least in the history of this magazine, and almost 150 in the life of this denomination. They occur in a context of careful, reasoned, thoughtful engagement with society. And it would be my encouragement that as we move forward, we not be intimidated by those who say Adventists shouldn't be involved in politics.
Good for questions.
If it's time for questions, I was going to have it turn this mic around, or if you want to.
No, that's fine. Okay, so we do have some time for questions for this very non-political issue. And folks, when you're answering them, I'd ask the panel if you would come to here and speak so that we can get this all recorded. Yes.
My question was incited by something that Alan said about polygamy. How is society drawing the line in terms of what is acceptable and what is not within the bedroom? If homosexual marriage, why not polygamous marriage? Why not incest? Why not marriage with children? How would the state have any kind of an argument with the Mormons, some of whom have been arrested because of their kinds of religious marriages and their extreme cultic right wing, whatever it is? There was, you may have heard in the news, not too long ago, a Saudi man marrying an 8-year-old girl, and that was upheld in the court because that was a contract between the parents. If that's acceptable within that culture, and if we have a postmodern political correctness of accepting whatever is acceptable within anything, then why couldn't, say, Muslims in this country do those kinds of things? How do you draw the line? What is the standard of making these kinds of decisions?
The short answer, of course, is I don't know. We don't know what the standard will be. We don't know how far the principles of equality and intimate discrimination and the government respecting cultural differences will go. And by the way, this is not an academic question for Seventh-day Adventists. We have within our tradition this wonderful story about the conversion of the survivors of the Bounty and the story of Pitcairn Island. Less well known is the culture that developed there or was the Polynesian culture that had taken root there, and the trials that took place in Australia regarding the sexual practices and the deflowering of the young women as early as 10, 12 years old in our generation. So, when it comes to issues of sexuality and culture and what the law will respect, we really don't know. I don't know that the legal scholars are yet willing to come out and really discuss issues of incest. I think age of consent is clearly in play. We know that the numbers game is clearly in play. There's no logic to why a bisexual should not be able to find committed fulfillment with someone, of each gender. There's also some very interesting discussions about what is gender. The whole transgender movement has raised questions, well, are you a man or a woman? And what does that mean? Are you in transition? And how do we define gender? When the Bible uses the term Babylon with a core meaning of confusion to describe the world situation before the coming of Christ, it is a very profound and apt description, I think, relevant to this discussion.
Just to give you the Canadian perspective very quickly, in Ontario, the Court of Appeal has said that a family of three is protected. In British Columbia, the Attorney General was advised by his counsel, that there is no constitutional basis for prohibiting polygamy, and a prosecution was set aside on procedural grounds this last month. So there's no doubt that that's going to be the case. And on the issue of transgendered individuals, our firm is currently representing a woman's health club that is currently being brought before the Ontario Human Rights Commission for refusing to allow a man to join that women's club because he said, I feel like a woman, and he was in the process of changing genders. And so we'll see what the Ontario government has to say about that.
Nick, yesterday you asked us to submit written questions, but I appreciate the change in venue. The very eloquent defense by the editor. I have a question which Adventist Christians face an issue of individual conscience today, being politically correct versus being spiritually correct. Jesus took both positions. In Matthew 22:21, he put Caesar first. He was politically correct with the tax. And then he reversed himself in Matthew 6:33, where he put being spiritually correct over being politically correct. And I just need an explanation from this great panel.
Bill, I believe your name was mentioned.
Perhaps I might see the situation somewhat differently in that I don't see Jesus reversing himself. I see him articulating an ethic which includes a response at a given moment which will allow his kingdom to proceed, and a response that in the latter instance more clearly articulates the ultimate goal of his kingdom and the loyalty all persons must have toward that, whatever their expedient circumstances.
We are a global community, and obviously we're talking about the U.S. and Canada because that's where we are now. What do any of you see or are aware of in terms of how this is impacting Europe or Asia or other parts of the world?
To be honest with you, I don't have a clear, distinct answer other than to say that we do know that Europe and Canada is very much in sync. We know that in Sweden, for example, there was a pastor challenge there, but ultimately he was successful with respect to his case dealing with same-sex marriage. So Europe and Canada, I would think, are in sync, but again, I don't have a lot of information to be able to say authoritatively.
James Standish is our UN
yes,
guy.
Yes, he'll be here this
coming
afternoon.
Later today.
Yeah.
But I think that's a nice summary, and perhaps James can add to it at the breakout session. I think we had a hand up here.
My question is going to be to the editor. The panel has adequately established reality that we're in a different world now. And I believe we can't turn things around. We're in a salvaging mode. Our children have been targeted. Our schools are being used as indoctrinational areas to change their mindset. And because of your recollection of history, we're supposed to be the head, not the tail. My question is, with all this being said, what are we doing? And I'm assuming that since Review is one of our major publications, and I hate for us to leave this place, receive this information, and not have any marching orders, what is Review going to do to bring the light of this dilemma to the masses? Because a lot of pastors, a lot of parents, a lot of church leaders still don't know what time it is. They don't even understand what we are facing. And I think because of the dilemma and because of what's happening, it's going to have to be some real specific information being sent that will not be politically correct. But I think that if you start to inform people, even though we want to help others, my main concern is what we're doing to educate our own so they won't fall for this agenda that is really, really in place.
My comments today are to illustrate the appropriateness of the church taking a position. What that position is will emerge from discussions like the conference we are at, that in fact a nuanced and carefully thought through and reasonable approach to dealing with the issue in society is what I hope as an editor will come out of my and others' engagement in activities like this. I will add that in the case of the specific magazine, we have published editorials in the last decade very clearly articulating both a very compassionate and clear articulation of the church's voted position. I was reminding myself this morning that just 10 years ago this month, the annual council of the General Conference, from which several of us just came this week, itself took a position, voted a statement on the church and the practice of homosexuality. It has the advantage of being both compassionate and clear, it seems to me. And I think our willingness to engage with those who may not see these issues the way we do, to have conversation, to talk, to dialogue, is an example of one of the good qualities in this movement that will indeed keep us headed in the right direction. It is not to stay indefinite forever, however. It is to gather consensus and to determine what is in the Bible and what is in the best interests of this church moving forward. I think those two come together nicely. And as the church gathers itself for this discussion, we intend to be presenting that information in as public a way as we can.
I'm concerned about what I have heard in pulpits, Adventist pulpits, that would be perhaps more of a minister that has no clue about his own homophobias. And I'm wondering, with what I'm hearing now, what are we doing to address that issue so that we can have more presentations that are presenting our message, but with the compassion. I'm thinking of a minister that I listened to teaching how to do one-on-one witnessing, and he had a saying, I say it kindly, and then he'd go on to say what he had to say. How can we teach our pulpits to say with kindness and to deal with our homophobias so that we won't be perpetuating something outside of what Christ and His Spirit present?
Alan will respond to that, but we also have a whole panel this afternoon that is directly going to address that.
I was going to say, frankly, that is a question for a different panel. From our perspective, I will tell you it has been an enormous challenge as we seek to advocate on public policy issues like Proposition 8 to maintain the balance where we recognize that our obligation to make the gospel accessible to all, regardless of sexual orientation, is absolutely primary. And so we have to avoid inflammatory language. And it requires much more diligence and care and sensitivity in dealing with this issue. It is a great challenge. And I would simply add for all of us this old saying that was referenced earlier about loving the sinner and hating the sin does not work in this context, because what is communicated to the sinner is the hate and not the love. So, you know, we do need to really think about how we frame the issues, how we discuss the issues, how we communicate in the Spirit of Christ. And,
I'd just like to mention, just thought came across my mind. I just recently picked up a book by Tony Campello, who incidentally wrote, I think, a statement in this book that was referred to earlier. He makes an interesting point. The book was, I'm just trying to Red Letter Christians, I think is the name of it. And he makes an interesting point in there about the fact that Mother Teresa came to the United States, and in New York City, in a stadium, which was packed with all kinds of dignitaries there and so forth, and this, you know, Nobel Peace Laureate came up and spoke with great urgency with respect to the issue of abortion. Now, by far, her audience was not at all interested in her position. However, Campello made an interesting statement. He said she had the authority to speak. And she had the authority to speak because she was in the ghetto in Calcutta, and she was ministering to people. And that gave her authority. And the idea came to my mind that we ourselves got to be very careful as a church. When we're dealing with this issue, do we have such authority? Do we have such legitimacy? Are we there on the front lines helping those and showing the love of Christ? Or are we instead standing at the pulpits and saying things that would be untoward? And so I think these are the kinds of things that obviously we'll be talking about, but it just struck me as you're mentioning it this concept of having the authority.
Hi, I'm a student at Andrews, and so I think that this question is pertinent as far as accreditation is concerned. And I thank you, Mr. Busey and Mr. Tripper, for giving the Canadian perspective, and I think this question is directed to you, Mr. Renack. And that is, the Bible stands clear on evolution. The Bible is, there's no question about that. Yet our schools still need to teach evolution in order to be accredited. So my question is, though the Bible stands clearly about homosexuality, what would be our stance on teaching about that and then being accredited? Could it be equal? I understand that one of them is scientific, perhaps, and one of them is moral or philosophical and moral. But what would that be?
It's such a broad question. It's hard to know where to begin because currently across the country, we don't have curriculum requirements mandated by the states for elementary and secondary schools. The closest we come to that, there's a case right now in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in California involving the admissions policies and standards at the University of California and how in order to be admitted you have to have completed your certain high school courses, and whether those courses will be recognized for admission to the university, or if not, then you have to get higher scores on your SATs. Curriculum issues are very much in play in the public schools, where, going back 20 years, there were battles when I was in New York over Heather Has Two Mommies in the kindergarten curriculum. Schwarzenegger in California just signed into law the bill establishing Harvey Milk Day in the California schools. So it's not just that the gay clubs can have a gay pride day at student option, but now the public schools, will be formally encouraged by state law to be promoting homosexuality in the schools. I think the curriculum issues come into play more directly in terms of some of the professional subjects such as psychology and social work and the standards for licensing and accreditation in those fields. Honestly, I'm not an expert on dealing with these accreditation issues, and so there may be a lot of areas where this can impact that I haven't considered yet. We have seen very recently an organization that is threatening to kind of corner the market on the accreditation at the elementary and secondary school level and not to recognize, for example, we in the Adventist system, we have our own accreditation standards and what have you, and some of the private bodies like Western Association of Schools, WASC, in our region in the West, recognize and cooperate with us in our own applying our own accreditation standards. Clearly, if these accrediting bodies corner the market and insist on their own standards, they could very well insist that curriculum require certain content when you're dealing with issues of what is marriage, what is family, which is relevant at various stages, including very early first and second grade. So it could very well become a requirement in Christian schools to teach the values of equality and all of the different forms of family. It isn't currently, but it could become that way.
And I would notice an important distinction between teaching about evolution, which a good Christian school can do without teaching the truth of it, and requiring the teaching of the moral acceptability of different forms of sexual expression.
Just to give you another Canadian context, we always seem to take it to the limit. But in Quebec right now, just this last month, the Quebec courts have upheld a law that requires schools in Quebec to teach about different religions. In other words, there's a religion class that is dictated in terms of its curriculum components by the state. Parents and teachers challenge that, particularly in the Catholic school system. And the court said, no, the state can teach can force you to teach a specific statement about religion. So the door is already open. That issue is wide open. And, of course, as you know, in the Trinity Western case, it wasn't a question of curriculum. It was just a question of if you personally take a particular moral stand, you are, by taking that moral stand, disqualified from teaching. So that both issues are alive in our country. And just to close in response to this gentleman, here is one of the books that's currently going around in Canada. It's called The Tyranny of Nice. Makes me very uncomfortable because the idea is that if you are nice, then the nice thing to do is to accommodate. And by accommodating, you are taking away someone's freedom. I'm very uncomfortable with some in this movement who would take a jackboot approach to this. In fact, when I first started taking the cases, I asked myself, is this because of homophobia? Are you advancing a homophobia agenda by representing individuals because of their religious freedom, the church's religious freedom, and an individual's religious freedom? I did a lot of self-examination before going on, and I would commend to you the statement from last night, which is, tell individuals what you believe about how you believe the Bible speaks to you. Don't tell someone else how the Bible should speak to them. And I think then you're going to be safe, and you're not going to cross the line into this area of taking the approach of, by talking about the Bible, you're condemning individuals because you're telling them how you think the Bible should apply to them. And as long as we make it personal, we're not going to cross that line.
Very good. We're into our break time already. Let's shorten the break time. Take 10 minutes, and I'll see you back at 10:20.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright 2009. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.